Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we are back in the saddle after EMS World Expo, and we finally have reconnected with Dr. Joe Holly after his deployment to Hurricane Matthew's response. So we're going to dig into that in this very special episode, probably a double episode coming up. Before we get to talk to Joe and our other special guests, we always have to take some time out for my esteemed co-host, Sam Bradley. Hey, Sam.
Hey, Jamie. It feels weird not having you sit next to me talking to you. We had such a great time.
It was a good time at Expo, wasn't it?
It was, and we ended up doing some of them were kind of like off the cuff, but we had some great interviews out of that. So I hope people are going to listen. But, you know, the weird thing was throughout pretty much the entire week, we had Hurricane Matthew in the background. And of course, you know, being the Disaster Podcast, we were closely watching that. And I was glued to the Weather Channel, you know, when I was in the room, and that was crazy. And then, you know, we were hoping to interview Dr. Joe. He was supposed to be there, but then he couldn't be there. And then the next thing we know, he's deployed. So we'd always said, if one of us gets deployed, how cool would it be to have like notes from the field kind of thing? But it seemed like communication just didn't work. Either didn't have good cell coverage, or the night you and I tried to call him, Skype went completely down nationwide. So I can't wait for this discussion and hear Joe's experiences. And we have our friends Kevin and BJ with us tonight. Hi, guys.
Hey, Sam.
So I'm sure they're going to have some good questions. So I can't wait. I don't know. What's the weather like back there, Jamie? I know winter's really setting in here in Colorado.
It hit the upper to mid 80s today.
Oh.
It was crazy hot for mid October, but it's that old East Coast phenomenon called Indian summer, where the summer weather returns for a couple of days up to a week or so. And it's going to be cooled down by the weekend. So we record on Tuesday nights, and we're going to have a close to 90 degree weather tomorrow. And then by the weekend, it'll be down into the 50s again. So,
well, Kevin, you probably still got some heat in Texas, right?
It's cooling down right now. It's only about 85 here.
Oh, well, we're hitting 30 tomorrow night, so I got to start bringing the plants in. How about New Orleans, BJ?
Oh, it was downright chilly today. It was two digits, so I don't know what we're going to do.
There you go. How is it in Memphis, Dr. Joe?
Well, hi, guys. It's great to talk to you again. Actually, today was a record high temperature day for Memphis in the upper 80s. We may have touched 90. And we, too, are expecting this big storm blast to come through on Thursday and drop our temperatures precipitously.
Wow. Joe, I'm going to have 100 questions for you, and I know everybody else is, too. But I think one of the first questions is, because I haven't been glued to the Weather Channel like I was when we were down there, what's the current situation? And, Jamie, I know you keep abreast of all of this with, you know, rising waters that were still a concern, especially in North Carolina
and
Virginia.
Well, I think, you know, just places got caught a little flat-footed because at first the storm was coming, then it wasn't coming, then it was going to be a near miss. And it actually, I don't think, really made landfall. The eye wall touched the coastline in a few places, but It never really technically made landfall, but for a near miss, we I think 45 people lost their lives in the U.S. as a result of this storm. So, again, we talk about how we could talk about the force of the storm and the level of winds and, you know, whether it's a level 4 or whatever hurricane or level 2 or level 3. It really didn't matter because, as Kevin has told us time and again, it's the flooding in the water that actually kills more people than the wind and the hurricane itself. It's the aftermath. And we saw that here, I think, as well.
Yeah, especially in areas where they don't expect that to happen because it's been 100 years since it's happened. And that always catches people off guard. So Dr. Joe, oh, nice pictures. Thank you, Joe. I wish the rest of you could see those. Why don't you just start telling us about your adventure? You got the phone call saying, we need you.
Yeah, and I think an adventure is a good description. So you know, we got notified, I think, on the 6th, if memory serves. I got a call and an email, you know, telling us that we've been activated. Usually what, so I went out the door this time, not with my colleagues at Tennessee Task Force, who also went, but as a member of the IST, which is the Incident Support Team. And it sort of functions like a command and control structure, I guess, for the other teams, as well as a support system to try to take care of some stuff for the teams that are, you know, out in the field and have limited capability, communication, et cetera. So we started that off with a big conference call within about an hour of the alert to, you know, get all the team members. There's about 30 people on that team routinely that kind of mirrors all the same functionality you might have on a task force. So there's communications guys and medical guys and logs guys and all that sort of stuff, you know, kind of getting all those people together. That was mostly just to kind of bring everybody up to speed. We everybody on the IST was deployed initially to near Atlanta, Georgia, to an Air Force base there that had some space to put us up, allegedly. And the task forces, initially were only about 3 task forces deployed, but by the time I made it to the Atlanta area, there were 10 task forces that were activated and on the move. And so we ended up with 2 or 3 teams situated down in South Georgia to be able to respond to Florida and Georgia, and a couple of teams sort of near South Carolina, and a couple of more teams a little bit further north than that, with you know, boat capability. And our job from the IST, once we got on the ground, was to begin several different things. From a very high level, it's mostly begin coordinating any requests that flow in from the different states for, you know, requests for teams. Also trying to gather intelligence information about everything from the weather to medical facilities that were, you know, functional and could be used by our teams, but also to find out which medical facilities were likely to be impacted, and trying to put together a communication network that would allow us to reach out to the teams when sort of more conventional methodologies were not available, i.e. cell phones and that sort of stuff. So it's a real challenge of putting together a radio system, that sort of stuff, that reaches over several hundred miles, honestly. So that was really kind of what the first 24 hours or so were about. It was myself and one other physician, actually a guy from Seattle, who at the end of deployment, of course, had to go home to the quote-unquote typhoon that was striking Seattle. So he, you know, I'm not sure how much downtime he got after he got home, but he was with us and was a fairly new guy to the IST. So we worked fairly closely together to try to get him up to speed, and I hope I was able to provide a little education for him. I don't know if I did it or not, or just scared him off. But nevertheless, he was a great guy and a real joy to work with, and super sharp. The other thing that we did, because we had such a large number of teams in the field, is we scaled up fairly quickly, and we added on about 15 additional members to our group. Which included 2 medical unit leaders. These are very senior paramedic medical specialist guys that are able to deploy with us and come out and, you know, allow us a bit more extension of our capabilities, and that'll make a little bit more sense as we get a little further into this. That was pretty much what the first couple of days or 24, 36 hours were like. We're just sort of trying to get some infrastructure in place, establishing our base of operations in a parking lot and setting up some tents so we had some place to live, and, you know, trying to get a few of those things done. The teams were pretty much doing the same things as they headed a bit further forward. Part of our job is to locate some place for them to go, hopefully that has some sort of facilities. We like to try to put the teams in somewhat nicer facilities prior to going to work. You know, it doesn't make a lot of sense to send a team out to a barren field someplace, have us spend all night setting up tents and eating MREs and be completely exhausted when they're supposed to go to work the next day. So, you know, we try to find places like military bases and training academies and that kind of stuff where we can put the guys where they at least have a bit more of a sheltered place to stay and hopefully can have a meal gotten in there to them, that sort of stuff. To try to keep them as rested as we can before we potentially put them to work the next day or so.
Joe, a quick question, backing up a step. How does the request to FEMA come in? Is that a state request to the feds, to FEMA, indicating that their particular state may need USAR? How does that work?
So that's a great question and actually a very complicated question. So in general, there are several entities that are, up and at in operation during one of these events. So it's everything from a state emergency operations center, the FEMA Region 4, which covers most of those states, had a regional coordination center that was open and had probably 20 or 30 people in it that were coordinating requests and, cataloging assets and all that sort of stuff all at the same time. And so we on the IST actually have guys that are called USAR specs or specialists that we will send to an emergency operations center, and their job is to explain to the folks in the emergency operations center, where we are, what we have the capability of doing, where do they think they might need us, just sort of performing that liaison function to let folks know what capabilities are there. We find that there's a tremendous amount of variability amongst the states as far as the knowledge base of the people that are working the EOC. And, you know, many times they have no idea that we're even in the area and can step in and help. But there's also concerns at the state level of, you know, we want to get our state teams out and everybody, it seems sort of paramilitary in a lot of ways, in that sort of everybody is out there making folks aware we're available for missions, and then the folks that are getting requests for different things to be done are trying to sort through that, make sure that that's a legitimate request, and what level of urgency is it, and who needs to handle it, where does it need to go, all that sort of stuff. So there's a lot of different things at work there, and those requests sort of flow in from many, many different areas to many different folks, where it gets vetted and then, you know, ultimately pushed on down to somebody like us to, you know, deploy guys and engage in the mission.
So that begs the question. I imagine the interoperability issues between even among the federal agencies as well as you and the state agencies is just astronomical.
No question about it. You know, we sort of try to integrate and support at a very high level at, you know, the FEMA regional offices as well as state EOCs. But when we have teams that are, you know, in an area and are bedded down at, you know, a fire training academy or the mall or a church or wherever we happen to be at the time, we usually reach out to local EOCs and local resources, let them know that we're there, let them know what we have the capability of doing, and that we're there to help them. And, you know, that if they need something, all that's required is, you know, just send a message to your EOC saying, you know, we need this team in action, and that starts the ball rolling. So it does make for, you know, many of the, there was an EOC in North Carolina near a small town that was a, you know, a huge complex that probably had 3,000 people there, trying to be coordinated from, you know, air transportation assets to law enforcement and search capabilities and rescue capabilities and firefighting and you name it. It's an awful lot of people to try to coordinate.
I can well imagine. BJ, you got any questions for Joe?
No, just impressed at the overall logistical dance that had to be done to get everything rolling in such short order. Definitely a magnitude better than we'd seen in the past with a lot of things. How long had it taken y'all to set this up to do your call-outs, Doc?
So that's a great question. You're right, the logistics are pretty amazing. So by the time I got to Atlanta, which was about 8 hours after I was activated, we had about 70% of the incident support team on site and working. All of the task forces were already on the road and drove most of the night to get to their staging areas. You know, I think we continued to enhance our capability when we appreciated that we had 10 teams we had to manage. And they were spread over many hundreds of miles. What we've tried to do in the past is to try to get the IST co-located with the task forces so that communication is much easier and we have sort of eyes on as opposed to having to rely on others to tell us what it looks like, that kind of thing. It's much easier if we can sort of do some of that ourselves. And the other thing that we do is we tend to, we'll send some elements of the IST forward very quickly. So we had our folks moving forward fairly early on to establish contact with the task forces and to start providing some eyes on and boots on the ground intelligence back to the rest of the incident support team. You know, after about, I'd say the first day and a half or so when the storm sort of skirted up the coast of Georgia, we did not have an awful lot of requests out of Georgia for anything significant. They had a few areas that clearly got some damage, but they seemed to have pretty good local resources in place. And part of what we began to do is take our teams that had been stationed in southern Georgia and begin to try to move them north, where we thought there might be additional impact, especially when it was clear the storm was going to push, you know, into North Carolina. We spent a lot of time talking about whether to move the incident support team forward. Obviously, that's a huge logistic effort all its own, especially by that time we had, you know, tents set up and we have support from the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency that brings out their satellite mapping capability and all that sort of stuff, plus large trucks that allow us some satellite communications and that sort of thing. So, you know, by the time those were kind of in place and operational, we weren't sure that there was going to be an awful lot of demand for us. Based on the sort of lack of demand out of Florida and Georgia. So we elected to sort of stay where we were since we kind of had a place to be and had some infrastructure in place. And then, of course, by the time the storm made landfall in North Carolina, we realized we were going to get some work out of there. And yet it we weren't sure it was worth trying to move the entire IST in that direction. So we elected to send some more people forward. That included myself and some other guys on the medical team and several logistics guys, a lot of communications guys and that sort of stuff. To get, you know, on the ground much closer to the teams and continue to allow the IST leadership and infrastructure to remain there and try to manage this thing from long distance. I think it worked fairly well. It was certainly clear to me that it was much more beneficial for me to push on forward. Part of what we were doing in those first couple of days was, as we got intelligence about areas that were being impacted, and we had teams that were on the move, whether that was just from one staging area to another, was to gather medical intelligence for the teams. And part of that role is really just half the time it's, you know, getting on Google and seeing what hospitals are on the map near, you know, a certain town or whatever. But we also use the geospatial guys to give us information about local nursing homes and local pharmacies and veterinary resources and all that. And we gather all that information and get the contact information down. We spend a lot of time on the phone calling those entities to find out, are they really open and can they really take care of patients and what can they do? That sort of stuff. So that by the time the teams are in the area, they already know what their medical resources are. If a team member got hurt, they know where the closest trauma center was. They know where the closest STEMI center is and that sort of stuff. And they're aware of things like nursing homes and that sort of stuff that may need to be evacuated. They know the address, and if we're able to, we've already reached out and made contact with them to let them know that we'll have some resources in the area. So a lot of that is sort of done long distance, but at the same time, the teams often get, you know, engaged very quickly, and the physician that's there with the team has a real hard time splitting duties between taking care of the team and being involved in ongoing operations and trying to reach out to find out whether or not the hospital in that town is actually functional or not. And that's an issue we can talk about in a few minutes. We actually had to sort of go engage on one of the hospitals there to try to see what their status was. So, you know, that was a lot of what the first couple of days were about. As we began moving things forward, we literally found ourselves about 6 hours away from our task forces by ground. Part of that was just a long way to travel. The other part was obviously roads were closed and traffic was terrible and took a long time to get anywhere due to folks evacuating and road closures and all that.
Yeah, Kevin, it's too bad you can't. He's been putting up some awesome pictures here on Skype, and one of them is a New Jersey Task Force One boat, your old stomping grounds. You have any questions for Joe?
I have a question in general. I don't know if you've ever discussed it before, but for the people who don't know, Joe, can you describe the difference or the main difference between a USAR team and a SAR team? I spent a number of years on a SAR team, but I'm not sure we ever discussed the difference for people who are listening, how SAR differs from a USAR. Can you spread some light on that?
Well, sure. I'll be glad to provide a little bit of insight on that. You know, the teams that I work with are part of FEMA's Urban Search and Rescue Response System. And that is 28 teams that are scattered all across the country, with about 300 people total involved in the team. The go team is about 85 people, so we're three deep in every spot, kind of thing. But they are equipped with a pretty substantial amount of equipment to do collapse structure, water rescue, hazmat environment operations, and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, it's modeled after many of the state level search and rescue teams, the SAR teams. I think from our standpoint, we are probably just the next step up the ladder in terms of additional capabilities, additional training, additional equipment that we can, you know, put in place and support a state team. We absolutely work with lots and lots of different SAR teams that were out there. That they have, I think, a greater level of variability from state to state and community to community as far as what their capabilities are. We had some awesome state and local and regional level boat teams that were working right along beside us that were obviously very well trained and really knew their business. And then in some areas we had you know, a bunch of law enforcement and fire guys that stepped up and volunteered to do what they could do, but were pretty limited by their lack of equipment and their, you know, especially things like logistics and communication and all that sort of stuff are a real challenge for some of those state teams. That they get engaged because they live in the community and somebody knows where to find them. But once they're out there, they sometimes struggle with how to integrate, how to communicate. When the scale of these things gets really big, as this one did.
Kevin, remind us the kind of water rescue you used to do. What kind of a team were you on? Because most people don't know that about you.
I did actually a couple of different things. I was obviously an SR team. We did not have a dive team, but the local fire department did. So I worked in conjunction with them as far as a limited amount of training actually in the water. Most of it was surface side as far as what training they're going to need or they should have, equipment recommendations, that kind of thing. And then whenever they did have a call out, because I was out in the EMS affair, we typically got called out right with them. So I did kind of a dual role sometimes. I was there as EMS, but also I helped out their the tenders. If somebody actually had to go in the water, I kept watching the boats whenever the boats went out, especially at night. Made sure all the lights were good and up, and people on the shore were doing what they were supposed to be doing to help coordinate the guys in the boats. It's difficult when, for example, a vehicle goes off the road and in the water doesn't have to be very deep. In this case, one particular one, it was a pickup truck that went over and through a fence into the water. And the water was only about 4 feet deep. But if you think about it, it only takes about 3 inches of water to drown in. So we had about 4 or 5 boats just to evacuate everybody from the boat to the shore. And of course, it wasn't a direct route. So they had to go from a launching point from the boats out and around. It's at night. So they had a lot going on. We had the fire department there with all their stuff. We had tow trucks there. So if people aren't in your direct line of sight, people tend to forget you're there. So everybody on the water and the boats had to coordinate with the guys on shore. So there was just a lot going on all the time. So if someone isn't keeping track and making sure people are doing what they're supposed to be doing, which sometimes is very boring. You know, someone needs to be doing that. And I wasn't the head person, but I was heavily involved in that. That was one aspect. Other aspects I've done as I've helped with the training, not the entire training portion of it, but the majority, and then providing resources for additional training, who to call, what team to come in, what agency they need to contact for specialized training that I couldn't do. So I've been involved in a lot of different facets of dive rescue, and I'm using air quotes, because it encompasses like we've talked about before, not just dive specific things like confined space and hazard materials and just a bunch of other stuff that people typically don't think of as needing in a dive rescue team or dive team.
Wow. Yeah, I can imagine.
I also had my dive medical technician, my DMT, or my dive medic. I know a bunch of guys who own dive boats that go out in the Atlantic Ocean. One of them in particular brings guys out to dive the Andrea Doria, which is a major wreck. Way, miles and miles and miles off the Atlantic coast. And that typically is a week-long trip. You're living on the boat for a good week because it takes a couple of days to get out there. It's very deep, very prone to accidents. You have to be doing technical diving. So there's a lot more involved in just throwing on a tank and a wetsuit and going down, checking out the wreck and coming back up. Potentially years of training, tens of thousands of dollars in equipment. So one of the problems is you're out there, it takes you a couple of days to get out there. So what do you do if somebody gets hurt? It's not on the coast, so the Coast Guard typically doesn't have any air assets or even water assets in your immediate vicinity. So what they did is they brought me on board as a dive medic. And there's a lot of, that could be a podcast in of itself. So my job was to monitor the divers when they come up before they went down. And just their overall, kind of like the diving dock on the boat. I was obviously not a dock, but that's the nickname we got. Because if they weren't feeling all that great in the morning, my job was, don't let them go down, because prevention, not just cure.
So wow, that's a lot of stuff.
I've been involved in a lot of water stuff over the years in various capacities, some very minor, some very major. And of course, as you've seen the pictures and videos from and the flooding, while I was in the SAR team, I was right there. Right next to New Jersey Task Force One.
Wow. So. Well, you'll have to see these pictures later.
And that's going to wrap up this first part of our two-part episode on the response to Hurricane Matthew in the East Coast of the U.S. with Dr. Joe Holly from Tennessee Task Force One's USAR team. And we're going to go ahead and follow up with part two of that coming up next week in the Disaster Podcast episode, so stay tuned for that. I do want to take a moment to thank our guests, first my co-host Sam Bradley, and also our guests Dr. Joe Holly, Kevin Reiter, and BJ Schneider for coming in and joining us on this episode and chatting. We're going to have more to come, so stay tuned and make sure you are hanging out and checking out all our episodes. Make sure you head over to disasterpodcast.com. Leave a comment in the show notes for any of the episodes there, and we will get back to you. We always look forward to hearing from you, and we will respond to your comments. Also, a special thank you to Paragon Medical Education Group, some of the best preparedness training for responders around that's out there right now, and we can't say enough about them. If you have a system that is looking for a new way to inspire and train your responders in your jurisdiction, I urge you to reach out to the Paragon Medical Education Group team. Find out what they can do. They can do all kinds of disaster and emergency preparedness planning training, including their famous cadaver labs and real tissue training scenarios where they actually will put the bodies out there for the responders to work on. Pretty amazing stuff, and you just can't beat it. So check out the experience, as they call it, by heading over to paragonmedicalgroup.com. You can also follow them at ParagonMedEDU on Twitter.
and also on Paragon Medical Group over on their Facebook page. And of course, there's a link at disasterpodcast.com. I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. We'll be back next week with the second part of this episode, so stay tuned. In the meantime, as Sam Bradley always says at the end of these episodes, it's important to remember that disaster medicine is not your everyday medicine.